This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast here on the New Books Network. My guest today is a good friend and close colleague, Dr. McComas Taylor, who is associate professor and also reader in Sanskrit at the Australian National University. And Dr. Taylor has completed a monumental enterprise. He has translated into English, an entire Mahapurana, none other than the Vishnu Purana. And if that wasn't exciting enough, it's available courtesy of ANU Press, open access. The link is in the podcast notes. Yes, you can access a brand new English translation of the Vishnu Purana at the click of a button. Welcome to the podcast, McComas.
Oh, thank you very much, Raj. It's so nice to talk to you.
Yes, indeed. We do a fair bit of emailing, random things here and there, but we so rarely have darshan of each other, albeit via this online platform.
So nice to see you.
Yes. So you've translated the Vishnu Purana. How did this project start up for you?
This project actually was suggested to me by a colleague in Baroda. And Baroda had recently brought out, or not so recently, in the last two decades, had brought out critical editions of some of the Mahapuranas. And they were actually looking for someone to translate the Vayu Purana, which is very, very long. If I remember rightly, it's 20,000 verses or something. And I thought, well, look, that would be lovely, but gee, it's a big project. And they said, well, actually, we're also looking for someone to translate the Vishnu Purana. And I'd just spent 5 years working on the Bhagavata Purana. I said, yes, Vishnu Purana. This sounds more like me. 5,600 verses. It's not impossibly long. It's a beautiful text. It's in lovely, simple Puranic Sanskrit that even I can understand. And so I grabbed this project with both hands. And that was about 6 years ago. It was about 5 years' work, and it spent nearly a year going through the editorial and publishing process. But that's how it really came about. It was a request from colleagues at Baroda. They wanted to see their critical edition translated into English. And originally we'd rather hoped to have a bilingual edition. I'd always seen in my mind that we could have the Sanskrit on one page and the English on the facing page. And unfortunately, that didn't come to fruition. I still have it as another project in mind, but that's looking forward.
Well, that would be so very useful. I remember, when was it? Oh, in my master's, I was studying the Valmiki Ramayana. And of course, the go-to is the Baroda critical edition and the golden translation. It's a beautiful translation. They just finished it, I think, a couple of years ago. But the clay edition, The amazing part is they have the Sanskrit in transliteration, I believe, if I recall correctly, right beside the English verse. So it's quite useful for study. So I can envision a Vishnu Purana version thereof. So many questions. Where do we start? One of the themes that has come up a fair bit recently, just by chance, by happenstance, I've recently had Greg Bailey on the podcast, and also I had a pair of fantastic scholars working on the Skanda Purana project, Yukio Yokochi and Peter Bishop. And so this notion of critical editions has come up. And so Baroda had prepared a critical edition of the Vishnu Purana. What does that mean?
A critical edition is a new edition. Scholars will lay out all of the manuscripts they can find. They'll lay them all out on a table, and they will go through it word by word and line by line, trying to basically come up with a new edition, hopefully without any mistakes in it, hopefully comparing the different manuscripts. There's a bit of a philosophy behind this, and much of the idea of a critical edition is to get back to the earliest version that must have been the ancestor of all of these other versions, all of these other manuscripts. I feel a little bit critical of this. This actually arose from 18th and 19th century biblical scholarship. The idea came from scholars who were working on editions of the Bible, and they believed that if they put all of the versions, let's say of the Gospel according to Luke, if they put all of these out on the table, they could get back to the original Gospel according to St. Luke and therefore capture the true Word of God. So scholars trained in this tradition came to Indian studies, to Sanskrit studies, and wanted to do the same thing. They thought they could capture the original text. And this has become a bit of a fetish. I've never really thought that the original text, maybe it never even existed, maybe scholars working in different places came up with different versions of the text, or you had a bit, I had a bit, we put them together. Who's got the original? I've always thought that the most important version of the text was actually the Vulgate, that is to say, the most common version of the text that everybody reads, the text that creates social discourse, so the text that is most influential, the most widespread text. However, critical editions do have a very useful function, and that is they give scholars like you and me a beautiful, clean edition with a minimum number of mistakes in it that we can work on. I don't regard critical editions as something that's unique. It's not the Ur text, it's not the original, but it is a very useful additional edition that we can work with. Now, one of the downsides with critical editions is they've actually rather killed off other editions or manuscript editions. So, for example, since the publication, particularly of Mahabharata critical edition, nearly all scholars will refer to that and neglect the other versions of that text. So while it's enormously convenient and it's wonderful, and everything pretty well is online now, it's wonderful to have these texts, it has actually rather limited the sorts of sources that scholars look at.
You know, on the podcast, as you can imagine, there are a variety of subfields, projects, methodologies, ethnographic work, textual work, various historical periods, a variety of methodologies. And, you know, my dharma, if you will, as I see it, is to showcase whatever the work is. In this case, there happens to be a great deal of resonance between what we study and how we study them. And I tend to share the misgivings or a slight discomfort with critical editions, and yet, much like you, I use them. You know, I worked on the Markandeya Purana. What am I looking at? I'm looking at Parjyotra's translation of Banerjee's critical edition, right, from the early 19th century, and I'm looking at it in English because the students read English, or the hopefully you're trying to reach a larger audience than the 12 specialists on the planet, right? And so they're convenient and we use them, and yet there is this tension there with a tradition that is consciously dynamic. And really, I see the modern understandings of the Purana, even the way it rolls off the tongue at times, the telling is on the tongue, the text is on the tongue. I see it as the most upgraded software, the most upgraded cultural software in many ways. I had my eyes opened a little bit by having the researchers, the in charge of the Skanda Purana project on the podcast. And really what they're striving to do is preserve as much of the texture as they can, probably not dissimilar from the apparatus of the Mahabharata critical edition, but it strikes me that they're doing it in a much more rigorous manner. So this is not an issue that will evaporate anytime soon, but Yuko Yokochi put it this way, and it really stayed with me. She said, and she actually produced the critical text for the latest volume of the Skanda Purana. She said, the critical edition is our hypothesis. It's a hypothesis. It's not a conclusion. It's what we hypothesize to be the common ancestor to all of these manuscript species. So I think that's worth talking about on the podcast. Now, Vishnu Purana, very few people before you have fully translated it into English. Who, if anyone before you, has done so?
One of the very first British Orientalists, H.H. Wilson, published a very good translation in 1840. Why bother retranslating it? Why have I spent 5 years redoing it if H.H. Wilson already did it? Well, there are a couple of good reasons. Firstly, the English language has really evolved in the last 200 years. His is very, it's very dated. The language is very dated. So that's one point. Another point is that his translation is actually quite bowdlerized. So it's been sanitized for a Victorian audience. You wouldn't want to shock anybody with anything too sexual. And there's quite a lot of sex and violence in Vishnu Purana that he thought to remove or just to gloss over. So when couples are having sex, he says they are disporting themselves. It's all very chaste. It's all very lovely. And so I've been able to update that. Again, he was working from a variety of manuscripts that are incomplete, and the critical edition, I think, is a better source to translate from. But finally, the Vishnu Purana is nearly entirely, or let's say 80% written in shloka meter. It's in verse. There is beauty in the language itself. And one of the things that I'm very pleased about with this translation project, and I think it might be unique among translations from the Sanskrit, I've rendered the Sanskrit shlokas into blank verse. Now, what is blank verse? Blank verse is English verse, but it's slightly metrical, but I haven't worried about trying to make it rhyme, but it is, I believe, and I hope, pleasant to read. It's pleasant to read aloud. And this is my way of honoring the musicality and the sonics of shloka meta. Of course, Vishnu Purana is actually, it was created to be sung or recited or chanted. And I really love the idea of somebody reading Vishnu, my translation in blank verse of the Vishnu Purana aloud, and I hope they will enjoy the musicality and the sonics of the English that I've used. So the verses, they have a little bit of rhythm, they have a little bit of metricality, they are faithful to the original. I haven't worried about rhyme, but I've tried to turn this into language that will excite and language that will stimulate, language that is beautiful.
You know, that's really, in my view, a really important feature of the translation. in that it's attentive to utterance, right? And this is so forgotten in our world, particularly in scholarship, right? And the travesty is that Sanskrit's so preoccupied with the production of sound, right, and the ways in which sounds elide or come together, and it's uttering them aloud that matters. So I find it so cool that you were attentive to that in translating it with an intention that it be uttered aloud in English. Book one, creation. Maitreya asks Parashara about the world. When Parashara, that best of sages, had finished his morning rites, Maitreya bowed, saluted him, and asked, "I've studied all the Vedas with you, Master, and all the legal texts and supplements in due order. Thanks to your generosity, none could say that I'm remiss in any of these works, great sage, not even my adversaries. You know virtue, fortunate seer, and now I'd like to hear about the origin of the world and how it will fare in future." It's there.
Don't stop, Raj. That was beautiful. I loved it.
This is unscripted. He's not a plant, I assure you.
That was really nice. So, Raj, this is what it's about. You're right on the money there. The Sanskrit is beautiful to read. The Sanskrit is beautiful to sing and to chant. And if any way I've been able to reproduce that in English, then I feel very happy and satisfied. And I love to hear the way you rendered that just then. I must say that another long-term project, I talked about one long-term project as being a bilingual edition. Another long-term project is to have an audiobook version, either with me reading snippets. Now, I will be reading snippets with an Australian accent. What I really want to do is to have maybe a more authentic Indian voice, either reading the whole thing or reading snippets, because this is the way it is to be experienced. As you say, in Indic culture, it's the power of sound. It's the shabda that is the pramana. It's the most important thing. And if there's some way of communicating that more easily, I think the easiest way is through an audio book or an audio recording. So this is something that I have in mind. And I've actually done some little experiments. There's some very good computerized, digitized voices online at the moment. Now, everyone knows the voice of Siri or the other sort of assistants. If you hunt around online, there's a good variety of Indian voices, Indian English voices. And I found a lovely middle-aged, sedate, well-modulated Indian female voice that I really, really liked. And I was getting her to read big chunks of Vishnu Purana, but the problem was she was having terrible trouble with the Sanskrit names. And so that whole project, I've had to put on hold. I couldn't teach her to pronounce these Sanskrit names correctly, so I've just had to leave that. But it's certainly a long-term ambition to have this available in some audio format. So you can play it on your iPod, you can play it in the car. That's what I'd love to do. That's the next stage of this project.
That's fantastic. Listen, I know a guy. Let me know. We'll talk. We'll talk. I'll have my people call your people. We'll figure it out. That's fantastic. How did you become so attentive to the oral, the sonic, the uttered aloud dimension? Maybe talk a bit about your research with the Bhagavata Purana or Sanskrit or wherever. I mean, how did that? I really have to say, I know many, many fine scholars. They don't always have an appreciation for this dimension. It might be a musical thing. It might be a cultural thing. And yet, clearly, these texts were meant. I mean, yeah, one needs to almost be a reincarnate bard to actually bring them to life, you know. So how did you attune yourself to the texts in this manner?
I guess because I came to Sanskrit through Asian studies more generally, Raj. I didn't have the formal Indological training that most of my colleagues had. So I came through Chinese studies and Tibetan studies, where we were speaking and we were singing all the time. And so when I came to Sanskrit studies, I brought that tradition. I didn't bring a tradition of dry textual scholarship. I didn't come with this sort of Indological, philological background. I came from a literary studies background. And so as soon as I could, I learned to sing a little bit of Sanskrit. I studied with the wonderful Dr. Sadananda Das in Heidelberg and in Leipzig. I studied spoken Sanskrit with Sadananda. And so I teach my own students to sing and to speak. And I think the reason is that I actually came to Sanskrit from this different tradition, not from a philological tradition, but from a literary and oral tradition. And this was really reinforced by a wonderful project that I worked on before the Vishnu Purana, as you mentioned, the Bhagavata Purana. Now, the Bhagavata Purana is like the Vishnu Purana's, can I say, clever brother? Maybe that's not quite right. It's evolved. The Bhagavata Purana basically took the material from the Vishnu Purana and enlarged it and enhanced it and made it even more beautiful and more poetic and more courtly and more bhakti, more devotion-oriented. And it's important because it has a strong living tradition. Now, most of our Sanskrit studies, we're reading texts that, yes, they've been around for 3,000 years, but they're not widely read these days. The Bhagavata Purana is an exception because it's a widely read, widely recited, widely performed text. And for 5 years or so, I chased oral performances of the Bhagavata Purana around India and around the world. And I interviewed the professional scholar pravachakas, so these scholars who are trained in this tradition of telling stories from the Bhagavata Purana. So they'll sing or recite verses from the text in Sanskrit, and then they'll explain the story in the local vernacular to the audience. So this is a real living tradition of oral performance of a Sanskrit text, which nobody had really looked at carefully before I had undertaken this project. And one of my questions is, what makes these texts powerful? What makes them authentic? And what makes them able to touch people's hearts as much as anything? And it was the oral performance of it. It's the hearing the sound from an authentic source, from a guru, from a pravachaka, from an esteemed lineage. And again, this ties back to what we were talking about a few moments ago. The power is in the sound. The authenticity is in the lineage and the tradition. And so this, again, very much tied in with my own interest with spoken Sanskrit, with song, with the beauty of the language. And again, coming to this as a literary, a scholar of literature rather than a philologist in the old sense, this all ties together very nicely for me.
So you and I have, interacted at some conferences, probably since the World Sanskrit Conference in 2015. And, you know, they're liminal spaces, and we've had half a dozen conversations, and then we've somehow managed to bounce emails back and forth. And I think I roped you into co-editing something that we'll talk about in a moment. And we have this sort of rapport. But you know, I really didn't know your background before I asked you on this podcast. And what's so interesting to me is that, the podcast host of this podcast may actually have started off in English literature. My undergrad degree was English literature was my first love academically. It took a circuitous route, which, you know, it's all about the scenic route. But what's interesting is that I came across the Devi Mahatmya in the liturgical context. I came across it chanted aloud, ritually intoned, I was I was at the AIIS doing some Sanskrit training in Pune. AIIS is American Institute of Indian Studies. They have fantastic language training, South Asian languages. And Sanskrit is headquartered in Pune, the city of Ganapati. it happened to be for the fall semester. So, of course, it was Durga Puja time. And the lovely, lovely teacher there, her name was Madhura. She was like, you know, a Yoda of Sanskrit studies. So many Sanskritists in the West have studied with her. Her family had this puja, this Durga Puja, where they were reciting the Devi Mahatmya. And I remember vividly how live the text was. And in between recitations, I actually was telling tales from the Devi Mahatmya, uttering them aloud. And it was just this experience, you know, and it's just, it really contextualizes the power of the text. You're giving me a thumbs up, so.
I totally understand where you're coming from, Raj. Yeah,
it's like you know me. that's great. So, having translated this text, well, why don't you say a bit about the overarching maybe structure? What is the Vishnu Purana made up of?
Vishnu Purana is basically, it takes the deity Vishnu and places that deity in his multiple manifestations. So Vishnu and Krishna, for example, are used absolutely interchangeably in this text. And places the deity at the center of everything. The Vishnu Purana is a history of the universe, right? From its creation, the origin of the gods and the origin of humanity, the development of society, the lineages of the sun and the moon, the advent of Krishna, the lila, the sports of Krishna, and then the destruction of the universe, the destruction of the world. So it's from the beginning right through to the end, and all the way through, Krishna, Vishnu, is at the center of all the narratives, at the center of all of the philosophy, and at the center of reality. Krishna, Vishnu, is Brahma, is the ultimate reality of existence. So that's roughly the structure. A history of the world, a history of everything, but also a guide to life. There's a section in the middle that I've called society. There's a whole book on social practice, on domestic practice, on marriage rites, on Shraddha, on the offerings for deceased ancestors, behavior in bed, behavior in society, behavior towards your guru, the stages of life, the duties of the different communities. So there's this whole section on a guide to life. And in fact, one of the working titles that I had begun with was the Vishnu Purana, a history of everything and guide to life. And I still think of it very much in those terms.
Well, you'll have to save that title for when you write your public facing commentary on the Vishnu Purana, you know, some decades from now, when you're even wiser than you are and you don't care what academics think and you but as for now, it's called the Vishnu Purana, and the subtitle is Ancient Annals of the God with Lotus Eyes. It's quite poetic. It's quite lovely. What, having done this translation, what's changed? What's changed about your perspective of the text or of anything, really?
Oh, well, that's a good question, Raj. You know, halfway through this text, I suddenly realized that I loved it. It was a good text. I've been enjoying it. I've been working on it maybe for a year, maybe 2 years. And then I can remember very clearly at one stage thinking, I really love this text because of its beauty, because of its poetry, because of its visions. And I think you and I share a susceptibility to the the sorts of images that are very commonly used, the tropes of Sanskrit literature, the gold, the elephants, the lotuses, the forest. You and I respond very warmly. The peacocks. You and I respond very warmly to what I call the Sanskritic thought world. The beautiful descriptions of the forest at Vrindavana, to use the Sanskrit pronunciation, so Vrindavan. The beautiful description of the passage of the seasons. It really captured me. About halfway through, I said, "Yes, I really love this text." And I haven't really felt so strongly about other texts that I've worked on in the past, but there is something special about this. And also, the fact that it's not particularly well known, it really has been eclipsed by and large by the Bhagavata Purana. And the Bhagavata Purana is sublimely lovely. It's a beautiful text, but it's in a different register. Bhagavata Purana is written as courtly poetry for rasikas. What is a rasika? A rasika is someone who enjoys the essence of poetry, a connoisseur. It's in a much more difficult register, much of it. Whereas Vishnu Purana is written in workaday Puranic Sanskrit, as I said earlier, and is in that sense is much more accessible. It's rather less sententious than Bhagavata Purana. Every verse in Bhagavata Purana has a sort of a didactic twist at the end. Whereas this is more straightforward narrative and storytelling, I think.
Well, one's a symphony and one's like a rock concert. Or some sort of concert, soft rock, whatever does it for you. As a yes, the susceptibility. I guess you and I are easily seduced by the tropes of Sanskrit narrative. This is true. This is true. I had to mute myself because I was laughing as I heard you declare your love for the Vishnu Purana, or more than that, declare that you discovered your love halfway through. I have a secret to tell you. Something that I've long known. Unfortunately, I'm probably a life coach more than I'm an academic most days, but scholars are deeply passionate about the things they think are only intellectual curiosities. How I know this? Because they spend thousands of hours pursuing things and they're not embittered. So I'm not surprised you deeply love this text. And sometimes texts call to you, I find, and you don't even quite realize why you love them so until you analyze them. So I suspect some of that was happening with your translation project. Do you find it? What's your process like? How do you translate? What does that look like for you?
Well, translation is best done before the sun reaches the meridian, as you probably know, Raj. I can translate in the mornings. I get dumber and dumber as the day progresses, and really by the end of the afternoon, the best I can manage is taking books back to the library, quite frankly. So it's this question of capitalizing when your intellectual energy is most available, early in the morning, first session in the morning, 9 till 10:30. I'm a creature of habit. I love to work 9 to 5. I love to work 5 days a week. I keep this very, very, so it means I never get tired of it. I never get sick of it. So I keep it nicely structured. So I'll look at a verse. I'll do my best. Again, Vishnu Purana is not particularly difficult. I had some very good company during this process. Firstly, there was always, if I got stuck, there was always H.H. Wilson, 1840. If Wilson didn't help me, there are good Sanskrit commentaries. Now, commentaries are written by scholars in medieval times for people like me, people who basically know Sanskrit but might get stuck every now and then. And so the scholar, a commentator, will take a word and will provide synonyms for it or a little bit of explanation. So I have some good commentaries. There was a Hindi translation that Hindi translations can be useful, but the trouble is that if they don't really understand the Sanskrit word either, they just put it into a Hindi sentence. So that's not as useful as it might be. And it's very important that I mention a wonderful translation of the Vishnu Purana by Peter Schreiner, a good friend and colleague from Germany. So Peter translated this some years ago, and his translation was also always at my elbow as well. So this enabled me basically to come up with a good, clear prose translation of each verse. On a good day, I could manage 20 or 30 verses probably. But then came the next stage of trying to render them into some pleasant, as I say, blank verse. So working over the English, reading it aloud, trying it out on people. So it flowed, so it was smooth, to bring out those sonic qualities that you and I have talked about. So first a prose translation, then rendering it into verse, and polishing and polishing and polishing. And I think all scholars do this. We find it very hard to let go of our babies. I kept on saying, just one more read through, just one more read through. And each time I went through it, I'd change a little bit until in the end, you just have to say, yes, enough, okay, and off it goes.
Yes, there's so many pieces there. Okay, the first piece is the translations you were consulting. Peter Schreiner's is in German, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, that's right.
And so, in German. And so how many English translations of the Vishnu Purana are there?
Well, there really is only there's really only Wilson's, and then there's an early 20th century retelling of Wilson, Dutt's translation. Dutt. He really took Wilson's translation, and strangely enough, he turned it into King James English. So he took all the yous and yours, and he turned them all into these and thines. So it's not a translation; it's really just a rehashing,
a rendering
of Wilson, and that's about it for English.
So what McComas is trying to say, which I'm trying to lead him to say, is, Raj, there are only two translations in English. There's one from 1840, and then there's mine. This is a big deal. I'll just
deal. It's a big deal, Raj.
Now, as to the second part of your process, the poetic dimension. So would you literally utter them aloud? Would you share them with people as you're working through them and ask their opinions?
I have uttered them aloud. I have shared them with people. And I've had my audio assistant. I've had these computerized voices reading them aloud. And that's actually not a bad way to do it, because then you hear somebody else reading your own text back to you. And you think, oh, gee, that's not quite right. Or we need a comma here. Or that word's not quite right. Move this phrase to there. So all the time, keeping an eye on the root text, because fidelity to the root text is for me as a translator and a scholar, is absolutely crucial. But thinking about how people are going to receive and consume this text, the fluidity, the fluency, the beauty of the language, and my computerized consultant, my electronic voice.
Your computerized consultant, we'll refer to her as Siri Auntie from now on.
Siri Auntie. I like it a lot. What was her name? I can't remember her name, but she was she's worked very well for me.
Oh, maybe, you know, rather than Siri, her name is Shri.
Shri.
We digress. If I'm not mistaken, there was also a recent translation that was useful or an inspiration to you. It might have been the Harivamsa translation.
That's exactly right. There are a couple of translations or retranslations that really influenced me. So our friend and colleague Simon Brodbeck from Cardiff has rendered the critical edition of the Harivamsa into English. Now, that had a big effect on me, Raj. It was the first time I read a translation of a Sanskrit text that didn't read like a translation. And this is something really different. It read like fluent, natural English. Simon's work is a beautiful work. He's done a lovely job with that Vishnu Purana. And it threw a switch for me that it is possible to translate Sanskrit into English such that it is faithful to the original but doesn't read like a translation. That was the first thing. So Simon's work had a big influence on mine. The second thing is Carol Satyamurti published a blank verse retelling, a rendering of Mahabharatam. Now, it's not a translation. So her methodology was this, as I understand it. She would read a chapter or one or two chapters, and while it was fresh in her mind, she would create verse retelling what she had read. So it's not a translation, not a word-by-word translation. It's a recreation in blank verse. And that's a beautiful text. And again, she's captured the sonics of the original. She's captured the musicality of the original. So it was a combination of these two, Raj. It was Simon's work that showed that you could translate English, you could translate Sanskrit into English such that it didn't read like a translation. And secondly, Carol Satyamurti's work, that blank verse is a beautiful way to render Sanskrit texts.
That's beautiful on so many levels. I realize you love the text. What bits were most exciting to you, or what stood out to you, or what parts were the juiciest to you, the most interesting, the most fun to translate?
Oh, I love the stories of Krishna playing in the forest at Vrindavana. There are lovely passages of autumn in the forest. There are lovely passages of Krishna subduing these various demons sent by Kamsa to destroy him. I think of those demons, the serpent Kalia, who lives in the Yamuna River, is polluting the Yamuna River and is rendering the district around unusable to the cowherding folk. And Krishna goes to subdue this serpent by dancing on its hood. The serpent's wives come out with their swaying bodies and their glistening earrings, and they beg Krishna, please desist, please spare our husband. And Krishna desists and spares the serpent, and the serpent becomes a devotee, pays homage to Krishna, and then departs to the ocean whence he had come. These are beautiful passages, and they're a little bit playful. They're quite devotional, lovely imagery. And I think these are the ones that really sparked my interest. And if someone wants to dip into Vishnu Purana, Krishna subdues Kalia would be a very good place to start.
Fantastic. So the text has succeeded in facilitating bhakti even in its translator.
I don't think you can spend years engaging with these texts without them touching you in some way. You'd have to have a heart of stone, I think, really, to remain completely immune or untouched by these texts, right?
Well, they're transformative, right? They're meant to be transformative. They're unassumingly transformative. They're folk narratives that encode such profundity if you pay attention in a playful way.
Yeah,
it's it's profound, actually. Is there anything else that you wanted to share about this translation of the Vishnu Purana?
I love the fact that it's open access. I love the fact that anyone anywhere in the world can download it for nothing. I really hope people will access it and enjoy it. You wouldn't necessarily read it from one end to the other for pleasure. In the introduction, I've indicated a couple of the more accessible and more enjoyable passages, some of the Krishna passages, for example. I love the idea of this text, which has really sat on the shelf for a long time. It's not widely read. It's not widely known. As I say, there's a translation from 200 years ago. Here it is. Again, it's accessible to everyone. And I love the idea of people enjoying it.
Fantastic. Let's make mention that there will be another publication, Open Access at ANU Press, in the not too distant future, maybe in a year or so. I think that someone, maybe the podcast host currently, has roped you into co-editing this thing with this poetic and or cheesy name that he came up with, Visions and Revisions of Sanskrit Narrative. Do you want to say a quick word about that?
This is an exciting project, Raj, and I don't think you roped me in. I think I leapt at the opportunity to work with you on this. Again, it brings together a whole lot of things I love. I love the literary approach to the study of text. You know, it wasn't that long ago I was at a conference. It'd be 20 years ago I was at a conference, and a German scholar said, we are interested in Sanskrit text, but we are not interested in your opinions about literature. And he had rather misunderstood what literary studies were. I said, but every year there must be 100 PhD theses written about Goethe, 100 PhD theses written about Schiller. And he stroked his long grey beard and he said, yes, well, Sanskrit is not yet ready for literary studies. Perhaps sometime in the future. The future is here. The future is here. We are doing literary studies of Sanskrit texts. So that's one thing. The fact that most of the contributions to this collection are literary studies, that's important. Secondly, I love the fact that there are so many studies of Puranic texts in this forthcoming collection. Historically, Puranas have always been on the outskirts. They haven't been central. People have been very much concentrated on Vedic texts, the Brahmanas, Upanishads, courtly poetry. But the epics, of course, have been absolutely central. But to see scholarship, such good scholarship on Puranic texts, I think it's very exciting. And, of course, the collection has some great papers from really good scholars on epic texts, Mahabharata particularly, Ramayana as well. So such a nice collection of literary insights into narratives found in the epics, Mahabharatam, Ramayanam, and Puranas. Very exciting project.
You know, this whole literary thing, unsurprisingly perhaps, I really, really resonate with what you're saying. This guy that roped you into this podcast, I think he might have done the first literary study of the Devi Mahatmya. You know what's really bizarre? I've never quite understood why we clicked the way we did. Until now, until this podcast, I now consciously understand the way of being that we've sort of internalized. And obviously, it's not just the two of us, but I understand now why there's just this synergy and this instinctive methodological approach to these texts. They are literature. They're phenomenal literature. And just because they're not meant to be read cover to cover, or they're not produced by a single author in one sitting. See, this is the paradigm shift. They're multi-generational. They're like a house that's renovated age after age by people attentive to the design, attentive to the needs of what the plumbing or the vastu or whatever. And there's just such extraordinary method to the madness of these texts, if you sort of know how to look, and obviously frame narratives are key. But yeah, apparently within a year or so, there'll be this exciting open access volume, Visions and Revisions of Sanskrit Narrative with ANU Press, featuring some phenomenal scholars. I have to say to you, it's a bit of an out-of-body experience, although I'm doing the monkey work of the correspondence. It's still an out-of-body experience to kind of see the names that have said yes to this thing. It's like, okay, great. I'm not, people might think I was bribing these people. I don't know why they all said yes, but some of the biggest names in our field easily are contributing to this volume. So it's really cool to see it come together, to be honest with you.
No, great project. Very happy to be part of that. And I think this will be a real milestone in studies of Sanskrit narrative literature. Probably the most important thing since Purana Purenas, which came out, that must be
93, I believe.
Nearly 30 years ago. So this will be a milestone with such good scholarship, such interesting and generally accessible articles. One of the things I really enjoyed about working on the vision and revision text is the readability of the articles. Yes, they're written by outstanding scholars, but they are written in a generally accessible mode.
Fantastic, fantastic. So in the podcast notes, we'll obviously put links to your website, to the Vishnu Purana translation, of course. And also, well, I think we met at the World Sanskrit Conference probably in 2015 for the first time in person. That's kind of surreal because I don't know when we met again. It's a triennial conference. So 2015, we met in person, then 2018 again in Victoria, BC, Vancouver. And then 3 years later, which was last year, it didn't happen. So it'll be next year. And where is it going to be?
Well, the World Sanskrit Conference should have been in Canberra, Australia in January this year, but like everything else in the world, it was turned upside down. So we postponed it to January 2022, and we will be making an official announcement on the 1st of July as to what we are going to do. I'm sorry to say that the World Sanskrit Conference will not be held in January 2022, as it's most unlikely that the Australian borders will be open to international travellers by then. But on the 1st of July, we will make an announcement. And that announcement, I don't mind leaking this to your audience, Raj, we're going to postpone it another year. So the World Sanskrit Conference will take place in Canberra, Australia, in January 2023.
Wow. You heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen. Mind you, by the time this podcast is out, it might be post-announcement. Well, maybe I'll expedite the publication of this podcast. I'll see what I can do. So then, if all goes as planned, there'll be two conferences 2 years in a row.
We haven't spoken to our colleagues in Kathmandu, where the next conference is to be held. It seems almost certain that they will postpone as well. I think this will push the schedule out. The whole world has been turned upside down, Raj, and Sanskrit studies has certainly not been immune to the trauma, to the disturbance that the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, anyhow, the aside from the pandemic pressures and these interesting times, to say the least, that we're in, the World Sanskrit Conference is very much a vibrant entity, and I look forward to when next it will meet in person, when we'll feature some fantastic Purana papers, among other things, various Sanskrit papers. Fantastic. Is there anything else that you wanted to share before we close for today?
Just one other thing, Raj. If any of your listeners are keen to pursue Sanskrit studies, we offer an online Sanskrit course that is in some ways unique. It's offered through Open Universities Australia. If you just Google Sanskrit Australia, you'll come straight to us. It's unique in a couple of ways. Firstly, it's a fully accredited tertiary course. So this course is not a community course. It's a tertiary course and will count as credit towards a degree at a university anywhere in the world. That's one thing. And another thing is that it incorporates an element of production of Sanskrit, not just reception. What do I mean by production? I mean students learn to speak Sanskrit, they learn to chant Sanskrit, as well as the normal scholarly disciplines of mastering the grammar and being able to read and write. So it's a highly innovative course. It's online. It's supported by an e-text. The entire first year syllabus is captured in an e-text called Joy of Sanskrit, which anyone can download free from the ANU Press. And then we meet. So it's actually a flipped classroom. Students work online for 8 hours by themselves, and they come together into a web-enabled classroom with me for 2 hours every week. So please, Open Universities Australia Sanskrit, you'll come straight to us, and we start again in February next year.
Fantastic. Well, this has been a rich conversation, at least as far as I'm concerned. thank you very much for appearing on the podcast today, McComas.
Oh, it's been so much fun, Raj. I always enjoy our interactions, and I've particularly enjoyed speaking to you today.
Fantastic. For those of you listening, we've been speaking with Dr. McComas Taylor, Associate Professor and Reader in Sanskrit at the Australian National University. He teaches Sanskrit online. Check it out. And more to the point of this podcast, he has just produced for the first time in nearly two centuries an English translation of the Vishnu Purana, Attentive to Utterance, available open access online. Links in the podcast notes. Until next time, stay safe, stay sane, and keep uttering Sanskrit verses aloud. Take care.